Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed then.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, there are three issues before the court today. I'm just going to start with the first, and I believe probably the main issue in this case, which is whether or not the trial court erred in considering appellant's failure to show remorse through testimony, the circumstance against him, and punished him more severely for exercising that right not to testify contrary to 3808 of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure and Article 1, Section 10 of the Texas Constitution and the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Now, this court has held in the past that feelings of remorse can only be shown through testimony. What the trial court said when sentencing the defendant was, and I believe this is quoted in the appellant's brief, but one thing I did not see from the defendant during any stage of this trial whatsoever was any hint of remorse for the crime of which he's been convicted. Now, as I just stated, this court has ruled that feelings of remorse can be only shown through testimony, and in this particular instance, the defendant did not testify. He elected to invoke his Fifth Amendment right and not testify at trial. Now, this court's had a long history of protecting Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Neither the trial judge nor the prosecutor, as a matter of law, is allowed to comment on the failure of an accused to testify, and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals has held that considering the appellant or the accused failure to testify as a circumstance against him violates his state and federal privileges against self-incrimination. We would submit that's precisely what happened in this case. In addition, 3808 says that a failure of a defendant to testify cannot be taken as a circumstance against him. In this case, the trial judge's comment is quite clear that he is considering the defendant's failure to testify, his lack of remorse, which can only be shown through testimony, when giving him his life sentence. That was, the defendant was already convicted of a 99-year sentence, and then at the murder trial, which is what we're in front of today, he was given a life sentence, and this was stacked. The state notably doesn't defend the trial's actions really in its brief, and its main point is that the appellant has waived this issue by not objecting to the trial court's comments during the trial court proceeding. I would submit to the justices today that issue, the issue of having a fair judge, a judge that is impartial, a judge that does not consider a defendant who invokes his constitutional rights and uses that against him, cannot be waived. In Carroll v. State,
that statement was made just at the punishment hearing without the jury present, correct?
That is correct. But importantly, at the punishment stage, the defendant had elected to go to the judge for punishment, and so this is a case not only of the judge making the comment, because the state has cited a lot of cases saying that you have to object if the trial court makes some sort of comment to the jury. And there are all these cases, the trial court making a comment to the jury. But this case is a little bit different, and I think that this particular court, in fact, has encountered a similar issue in Carroll v. State, which was cited in the appellant's brief. In Carroll v. State, the defendant failed to object after the court stated that the defendant's failure to testify, quote, would reflect very seriously on the court's decision here. And in fact, as a result of that comment, the defense attorney in that case had voluntarily put the defendant on the stand, and that case was reversed. In Carroll's, the judge's statement was more ambiguous, I believe, in this case. In Carroll, the judge merely said that it would reflect very seriously. It didn't say how seriously. It didn't say, in what ways it would reflect badly. In this particular case, we know that the judge is considering the defendant's alleged lack of remorse, and again, the fact that the defendant didn't testify means that he's basically coming on his right, on his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. There are a couple of reasons why, such a fundamental thing does not require an objection. One is, the fact that this is I believe, a due process issue at its heart. You shouldn't be required to object, you know, to the fact you didn't get a fair and impartial judge, the fact that you didn't get a fair, you know, an impartial trial. That's fundamental, and case law has found that to be fundamental to the criminal justice system as a whole, and that such comments attack the point of the, or what makes the judge's comment so bad is not the comment itself, but the fact that it shows his thought process. That this comment that we have quoted gives us a window into the mind of the judge. We know what the judge is considering, and that's something that we don't often get. And that's why it's so important in this case, because not only is the judge the decider of the defendant's sentence, but he's also the decider, you know, should the defendant have lodged an objection. And so he would basically have to overrule himself and tell himself to disregard his own thought process. And clearly, I mean, that's not a reasonable thing.
So what's the harm analysis on that?
Well, Your Honor, because if the error is constitutional, the appellate court under 44.2a says the appellate court must reverse unless it determines beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the appellant's conviction or punishment, and that if there isn't a constitutional error, the court will disregard the error if it does not affect the appellant's substantial rights, which is when the error had a substantial injurious effect on the influence of the jury's verdict. I would submit to you that, Justice Walker, that this is a constitutional issue. We have, I think, you know, the right to a fair trial, and most importantly, the right to invoke your right to remain silent and not be punished because of it, goes to the very heart of the constitutional issues that we deal with on a daily basis in the criminal justice system.
Is there a case law saying that this type of error is constitutional error? What's your best case?
I believe, Blue v. State, which is 41 Southwest 3rd 129, which is a Texas Court of Criminal Appeals decision, supports that. I believe Carroll v. State is kind of discussed in this case, or as decided by this own court.
And then the remedy would be a new punishment hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe, at least for issue one, that what would be required would be that the judge who made the comment should be recused and that there should be a new punishment hearing in front of a different impartial judge. The state brings up
counsel on page 4 of your library. You make a quote of what you read earlier, I think. That the judge's words were, "But one thing I did not see from the defendant during any stage of this trial whatsoever was any hint of remorse for the crime of which he's been convicted." And as I understand your argument, you're narrowing down from that statement to contend that statement reflects a holding against the defendant the fact that he didn't testify.
That's correct.
Well, if the court is referencing any stage of this trial, that's more than just the defendant's portion of the trial.
That's correct. Well, I mean, we have to take it for what it is because the judge didn't elaborate. But I mean, any stage of the trial, you know, we can speculate he meant that, you know, any stage of the trial, I suppose.
Well, that might have been while the state was putting on its case and his observations of the defendant in terms of the court's observations of the defendant all through the trial appeared to me to be what he's referencing by the state.
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record supporting that the defendant was unruly or that the judge had to admonish the defendant concerning his behavior during trial. The defendant did actually take the stand on a procedural issue when he was put on the stand for because he had elected to go to the judge. And you can read and that is on the record, and you can read through there. And there's no indication that he is, that he's disrespectful, you know, or that he in any way is lacking remorse.
That portion of his testimony about his acknowledging that he elected to have the judge assess the punishment, that was before the statement, wasn't it?
Yes.
Are you familiar with any cases where a case has been remanded to have a different judge hear just a punishment hearing, one who has not heard the entire trial?
I'm not aware of any cases on point, Your Honor, but I would submit that this is a rather unique issue. There aren't many times where we have a judge that makes an improper comment to, and it's not to a jury. You know, oftentimes we've got a lot of case law on what to do if the judge makes an improper comment to the jury. We don't really, there's not a great deal of guidance on what to do if the judge makes the comment, you know, and that comment, you know, indicates that he's perhaps considering the defendant's constitutional invocation of the constitutional right against him. And that may be the appropriate remedy in this case. The problem you're going to run into is that if you just, if it's reversed and remanded back for just a new punishment hearing, you know, the only judge familiar with this is obviously the judge who made the comment. And so if you're reversing and remanding, you know, you're kind of already, you know, you're already in a position where he's biased or impartial. And so, you know, that is one, that may end up being the appropriate sentence in this case, just because you have to have a judge that both hears, you know, both sides if he's going to in fact do the sentencing. The state asks in its brief why we didn't just ask for a new trial, but a motion for new trial under Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure 21.2 is just a prerequisite for presenting a point of error only when necessary to get additional facts that aren't on the record. I'd submit in this case that the Court of Appeals has all the facts that it needs to determine whether or not the judge improperly considered that. I'd also point out in Carroll v. State, which was before this court, you know, there was no, at least from what I can tell from the opinion, you know, there was no new trial where additional facts, motion for new trial and a hearing where additional facts were brought out. In Carroll v. State, this court didn't seem to really, you know, we weren't trying to figure out whether the judge's ambiguous comment, you know, fully explore that. You know, that was decided that the judge's comment was enough. You know, that at that point, you know, you can't unring the bell, and that the comments that made, you know, show the fact that at that point he's biased. There's an issue.
The question that I have is, really, can, in the situation where the sentence that was imposed is authorized by law, can you ever show that a comment that a judge makes without the jury there ever really was calculated to cause and did cause the rendition of an improper judgment? It's kind of like the same situation of when a defendant claims that the punishment constituted cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment almost. It's like, well, if it's within the confines of law and it's authorized by law, how can you show? Do you understand my question?
Yes.
The harm burden is what I'm struggling with.
Well, to that, I would say, Justice Walker, that what the judge has to consider is the full range of punishment, not merely the maximum. It's not enough that the judge, you know, could give the maximum and did give the maximum in this case.
Right.
Is that the judge, in order to be fair and impartial, must be in a position where he can consider the full range of punishment. Our contention in this case is that he did not consider that full range of punishment, and that his comment, it's not that the comment itself is bad, although it is, because we've got a law of case law, how the comment affects other people, such as a jury. But in this particular case, our contention is that the comment provides us really a unique opportunity to get into the mind of a sentencing judge as he's a contemporaneous statement as he's making the sentence. And so because of that, you know, I think there is a real harm there. If you have a judge that cannot consider the full range of punishment, a judge that is using a defendant's assertion of constitutional rights against him in the punishment phase, then there is harm there. And at that point that you do need a new, at the very least a new punishment hearing, but you know, perhaps a new trial as well in front of a neutral magistrate, which the defendant is obviously entitled to under law.
Okay, so what if he did not impose a maximum sentence? I mean, what I'm saying is what's bothering me is that it looks like we're creating a rule that just says if a judge makes a comment like this, it's an automatic reversal. Because what if the judge didn't impose the maximum? What if he imposed, you know, 60 years and then stacked everything?
Well, to that, I guess I would go back and if I could just finish.
Yes.
Okay. To that, I would go back and say that, again, the whole point, the point isn't the specific sentence made, you know, whether he gave him the, you know, a life sentence or whatnot. It's the fact that, one, we don't really know how much that influenced him. We can't tell, you know, whether he added 20 extra years because, you know, he improperly considered or if he acted 1 year or 1 day. We don't know that. And because we don't know that, that's where the harm really becomes. Because otherwise, there would be effectively no way if a judge made a comment like that and in fact said, you know, I'm sentencing, if he just went out and said, I'm sentencing this defendant more harshly because he invoked his Fifth Amendment right, you know, and he made a comment like that. Well, you know, it's hard to point to a specific amount of time that he added on to that. But I think the fact that you would have a judge that would make that sort of comment, you know, raises some pretty serious issues on whether or not the defendant even got a fair trial or a fair punishment in the first place. Thank you.
Mr. Hoover?
May it please the court. The appellant has raised three issues here, and it's the state's contention that, as pointed out in our brief, that the defendant waived any error as to the improper comments made by the court, and he has no right to complain for the first time on appeal. The second issue, which was not mentioned a minute ago, is whether or not the detaining officer who had detained the suspect in the Walmart parking lot there in Wichita Falls had acted under a proper investigative detention. And it's our contention that he did. And thirdly, that there was no error to deny the improper requested instruction in the charge. There was no proper instruction that was requested. If there is any error, it was harmless. I'll first answer the defendant's assertion or the appellant's assertions as to issue number one, which is what we've handled today. As stated earlier, we'll contend that this is constitutional error, and I believe there are cases that say that when you have a comment about Fifth Amendment rights, that it is constitutional error. Some of those cases you can look to. I think Phelps v. State would say that, and I'll cite that in a minute and give you the full citation, and also Barrett and Griffin. But this is constitutional error, however it's waivable in this case. And under TRAP, or Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1, as you're well aware, the general rule is that error at trial is waived if not brought to the attention of the trial court. There are three primary categories of rights, and these are identified in the party's briefs. The first and the highest.
But counsel, what would have happened? I mean, if there's an objection, how does the trial court hear something? It's not like he can instruct himself. I mean, how would an objection have changed anything?
Well, if nothing else, an objection would have given the court an opportunity to explain himself. Did the judge mean that he took that into consideration? Did the judge misspeak? Did the judge, what was the judge thinking? Certainly there is no objection here to preserve that error, and there is no objection to allow the court to explain himself or to say something. So ultimately here, what you have is the appellant asking you to use that statement as a portal into the mind of the judge to reverse this case and to, as you said, to create a rule that if a judge makes some comment that we say, okay, that's improper, so we're not going to reverse this judgment and sentence. That's what that rule would create. But to do that would ignore the fact that a year prior, in September 2009, a jury not only convicted the defendant of unlawful possession of a firearm, which was enhanced, but then that jury considered this exact criminal history that he had from Rhode Island, Arizona, New Mexico, and now Texas, and looked at the facts of the case, which was a third-degree felony, which was enhanced. And then that jury, a year prior, which is a control group to look at, sentenced this defendant to 99 years based on a third-degree felony. And then this jury, a year later, September 2010, convicted the defendant. The judge considered that same punishment evidence, which was the criminal history, the facts of the case, and then for murder, a first-degree felony in and of itself, which was enhanced, sentenced the defendant to 99 years or life. So just as Justice Walker pointed out earlier, there's really no gauge to determine. It's within the range of punishment. How are you going to create this rule and say, well, clearly this was unfair because this judge made this comment, and because of this one sentence or these two sentences, we know that this judge was biased and this defendant did not get a fair punishment hearing. There's a lot of case law out there referring to this Fifth Amendment issue. There are plenty of situations where prosecutors and even judges make comments improperly in front of the jury, and it taints the jury, and there's case law strongly in favor of preserving that right, that Fifth Amendment right not to testify. However, in those situations, and there's case after case, some are cited in the state's brief, and some I have some newer cases that I mentioned to appellate counsel before the argument today. One of which is, let me first go to Phelps v. State, which is a case from this court. It's a memorandum opinion authored by Justice Livingston. The citation is 2008, Westlaw 1867983. It's from April 24th, 2008. And in that opinion, this court denied relief to an appellant who argued that the trial judge failed to consider the full range of punishment by improperly holding appellant's failure to testify during the punishment phase against him and sentencing near the top of the range. And what the court said there was that he waived error. And so they weren't even, this court wasn't even going to consider the merits because the defendant didn't object, which is what we have here, and that's our basic argument, is that it is a waivable right. It's not in that category of systemic rights to where you automatically get that right. It's either a waivable only or a waivable or forfeitable right, which is the lower category of rights. And if you don't raise that issue, then you can't bring it up on appeal and argue that. Now, I understand the appellant's position that they're saying that this goes beyond that. This goes to the fact that this was a trial and a judge that was so unfair and so biased that you don't even get a fair trial. And in their brief, they cite case law to that effect. But some of these cases are definitely distinguishable. Some of the cases that are cited are Aviles, which is a Houston case from 2011, the First District, 333 Southwest 3rd, 661. In that case, it says that due process requires that a criminal trial be held before a judge with no actual bias against the defendant or interest in the outcome of the case. And then there are also U.S. Supreme Court cases which talk about in the past when judges have been so biased that a defendant did not get a fair trial. One of those cases that's cited in this, the appellant cites the Arizona Supreme Court case, and that case cites Toomey, which goes back to 1927 during Prohibition when, it might have been Ohio, I forget which state it was, but there was a mayor of a city who was actually serving as a judge as well. And there was an individual who was accused of bootlegging alcohol, and he was tried by the mayor, and the mayor had a direct pecuniary interest because he wasn't going to get paid as a judge unless the defendant was convicted. And that court said, look, you've got a judge who has a direct interest, a pecuniary interest, and that's an example of when a judge is biased against a defendant and you actually have evidence of it. In this situation, you don't have any evidence of it. You have this single statement, and they want you, based on that statement, to reverse this case. However, the standard has not been met. There is no showing that the defendant didn't receive a fair trial, and that issue was waived by the defendant.
Isn't the standard, though, that under 3.2a, the Court of Appeals must reverse the judgment and conviction of punishment unless the court determines beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the conviction of punishment?
That is,
you're saying, if you agree with that, the proper
standard? I agree that that is the proper standard. I am saying that that error was waived, and I'm saying that there is no evidence.
Let's say we're not buying the waiver.
Okay. Okay.
If we're not, are you saying then that it has been proved beyond a reasonable doubt that even though the only way you can show remorse is by testimony,
That's what I'm saying, Judge. I'm saying that there, it is a giant leap, as I said before, to look through this statement as a portal into the mind of the judge, as they would ask you to do, and to declare and reverse this case that this judge was biased and that the defendant did not receive a fair trial. And as I said before, this case is, it's such a good control group in this case to look at what a jury did almost exactly a year before with the same set of facts, punishment evidence, and everything for a third-degree felony that's enhanced, and they gave him 99 years. And then this judge gave him what is practically the same sentence, which is life, based on a murder, a conviction for murder.
We have to find that he wasn't fair or that he was biased. If we just find that he has been proven
beyond a reasonable doubt, the comment did not, or the, actually it wasn't a comment, it was the mindset, the thought process did not contribute to the punishment. That is their argument. The standard is what it is. You have, as you stated, correctly stated the standard, it's reversal is required unless you find beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't contribute. But it's our contention that there's not enough evidence other than that one statement and their argument, there's not enough evidence to show that that occurred. And so it's our contention that beyond a reasonable doubt, you can show or you can see that it didn't contribute. And if I may move on to issue number two, this issue, luckily, makes it easier for you to decide because it's already been decided by the Amarillo Court of Appeals. Because of a docket control order, this issue was farmed out to the Amarillo Court, and they already issued an opinion in which affirmed this issue that the investigating officer did have reasonable suspicion to detain the suspect there in the parking lot where they immediately found a gun inside of his pants. Officers approached him at gunpoint. He matched the description of the suspect. They'd already found a dead body in the motel room. And the court said that the timing of finding the gun was key in that case. Therefore, it was not an improper arrest.
Is PDR still pending on that?
No, that has PDR was denied August 24th, 2011, 2 weeks ago. So that case has been affirmed. And this issue has been decided already. And that court said that there was reasonable suspicion to detain the suspect, and there was probable cause as soon as the officer asked him, do you have any weapons? And the suspect said, yes, I've got a gun, and they immediately found the gun. So there was probable cause as soon as that occurred. With issue number three, this is the issue as to whether they were entitled to the instruction involving the reasonableness of self-defense and deadly conduct. Let me first point out that from reading the brief, you know this already, that there were jury instructions as to self-defense and deadly conduct in the charge. The jury was charged on that, and they got to consider deadly conduct and, they got to consider self-defense and deadly force. The only thing that was not included was an instruction to the jury that you will assume that the defendant acted reasonably. And there's a reason why that was not included. The standard here is that if there was error and the defendant objected, reversal is required if the error is calculated to injure his rights. And alternatively, if he did not object, error must be fundamental. There's probably argument here as to whether he objected or not. What they did here was they offered a written instruction, a specific instruction, that only included the first prong of that presumption. And I know you're aware of that language, but the new law as amended, it might have been 2007 when it was amended, if I remember right, but it includes three prongs that you have to meet. And they specifically requested the first prong. And in the record, it shows that the defense attorney vacillated back and forth, what does he want? And the judge was very patient, it shows, and allowed them the opportunity to request one thing, no, it's this. And they decided they were going to request the entire presumption, and then they went back finally and said, no, here's what we want. We just want the first prong. But what that leaves out is that conjunctive language, the next two prongs, which are that the individual did not provoke the person against whom the force was used, and the word and is used in the statute, was not otherwise engaged in criminal activity. So here, the request and instruction was improper and incomplete. Secondly, he was not entitled to the presumption because he was committing an offense. And so it's easy to see why the defense would not want that presumption there because it couldn't have been considered because as he was committing this murder, as alleged, which he was found guilty of, he was also using a firearm, possessing and using a firearm to not only beat Mr. Summer to death in that motel room, But he also possessed that firearm before and after that. He took that firearm to Walmart, and there's video of him in Walmart leaving and then exiting in the parking lot. So even if you find that it was error for the judge to keep that presumption out, it's harmless error because he wasn't even entitled to it. But we submit that the judge does not have a sua sponte duty to instruct on unrequested defensive issues. And here, it was as if the defense attorney was attempting to just put something in there for this court to consider to create new law, or for this court to consider. And that statement was even made. We just want an issue for this court to consider. That invokes the doctrine of invited error, where one party leads the court into error, knowing what the result will be. And there is a court case that you can look to that it's very similar to this situation in Johnson, which the citation is, it's an unpublished opinion, 2011, Westlaw 2090292. It's cited in the Appellee's brief. In that case, the court allowed there to be an instruction on self-defense and deadly force. However, just like here, they kept out the instruction on the presumption, and they didn't instruct the jury that the defendant was reasonable. And what they said there was that the defendant was not harmed because the charge contained a self-defense instruction and correctly stated the reasonable belief presumption. So if the jury determines that he did act in self-defense and that he was able to use deadly force, they could acquit the defendant, and that was in the charge. So there's no harm there. And that's a similar situation. So for all of these reasons, the state prays that you will affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Please, the court. I'm mostly going to focus on issue one because I think that's probably the one of greatest constitutional significance to the court. State's counsel was asked, you know, is there enough evidence to show beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, that this didn't contribute to the that this constitutional error, you know, didn't contribute to the appellant's punishment, and he said, you know, there was enough evidence to show that. I would ask the court, what sort of evidence would the state need in a case like this? Oftentimes when a defendant is punished, we don't have those sort of comments. We have no idea what's going on in the trial court's mind. You know, there's a presumption that a trial judge is fair and impartial and has considered all the evidence, considered the entire range of punishment, you know, and has rendered a judgment accordingly. But in a case like this, where we do get a window into the mind of the judge, and we know that he's considering the defendant's so-called lack of remorse, which this court itself has said can only be shown through testimony. In time,
that's the problem. Do we really know that he considered it? I mean, crime was fairly brutal, and the defendant was in a taxi cab talking about it, and it could be that the judge based his decision on the kind of egregious facts of the case, and that it was a comment he shouldn't have made, but he didn't necessarily weigh it in his decision. I mean, how do we know? It would be the same as if he said, well, the defendant had on a red shirt, or the defendant, I mean, he may have noticed that, but how do we know that he that it bore any consequence in his sentencing determination?
Well,
and I understand that's an unreasonable burden on you. I'm just playing out, you know, if we issue an opinion that says any comment like this, we're going to assume that it's a troublesome rule for me.
Well, Your Honor, it is a troublesome rule, but like I said, it's not a situation that happens very often because oftentimes we don't know. But in a case like this, you know, where there is, I think, a genuine question as to, or, you know, I think that it can be reasonably interpreted that the judge is considering his Fifth Amendment, you know, that we should err on the side of protecting, you know, the Constitution, protecting defendants' rights. I don't believe in this case, I believe there is reasonable doubt in this case that the error did not, or that the error did contribute to his punishment. I think the comment itself provides the court that opportunity.
So you're saying if we just can't tell or we just don't know, then it's not established beyond a reasonable doubt that it didn't.
Well,
that it didn't impact the sentence.
We'll never know with 100% certainty, because no judge is ever going to say, I am using your Fifth Amendment right, you know, your invocation of Fifth Amendment right specifically against you and punishing you accordingly. No judge will ever say that. But when we do have comments, you know, that implicate constitutional issues such as this, fundamental constitutional issues, I think the court has to err on the side of protecting the integrity of the judiciary, protecting a defendant's fundamental right to fair trial. It's one of the bedrocks of our society, and I think almost as a policy issue, you know, we need to ensure that the public knows that it, you know, that these constitutional rights, that there isn't a question whether or not that they can exercise them, that there isn't a question as to whether or not they'll be punished by a judge if they invoke these rights. That's the whole point of the constitutional rights in the first place, protect the citizenry and protect defendants. And so I think that, yes, if there are legitimate questions, if the judge makes a comment like this that crosses the line, that implicates constitutional issues, then I think that the, you know, that under 44.2, that the court must reverse, because I think that the trial court's comments have created that reasonable doubt. Again, this isn't a preponderance of the evidence. We don't decide whether it's more likely than not that he implicated constitutional issues. It's beyond a reasonable doubt, and I think that's a fairly decent burden. And like I said, as for the waiver issue, you know, as Justice Gabriel brought up, you know, realistically, what is that going to do? You're going to the person who has just made the comment and asking them to decide. At that point, you know, we would submit he's no longer a fair and impartial magistrate. That's the whole point of an objection, is that you can go to a fair and impartial magistrate and say, you know, you decide whether or not that was appropriate or not. In this case, when you have that, then I think an objection is not required. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you so much for your argument here today. We appreciate you coming down from Wichita Falls, and have a safe trip back.
Thank you. Have a safer trip.
Yes, I was in a car wreck about an hour ago. We were rear-ended on the way here.
Station.